The following audio is from The Village Church. More information about The Village Church is available at www.thevillagechurch.net.
So when Jeff and I took our first parenting class, the couple that taught it was like a video-driven class, and the couple that taught it would each week give these examples of what their family was like, and they were always these glowing examples that were just, you really wanted to hate them by the end of the video, and you're like, he's either lying or I want to kill him because it can't possibly be like that in his house. And so we're going to have to do some of that, right? Because we're teaching the class, but we didn't want to be that guy. So we thought it would be great if each week we started with a keeping it real parenting moment where we expose to you some of our more ridiculous failures in the parenting sphere. So with that in mind, I want to take you back to last summer. It was our daughter Claire's 11th birthday. And I, is that right? No, her 12th birthday. So already I've given you a horrible example of what how to parent. So I was, of course, responsible for getting the bulk of the presents, and I went to Target and was shopping on the clearance rack because that's how I roll. And there was this really cute sundress. It was modest. It was sweet. I loved it. It was an extra small. Our kids are tall, and so it was a women's dress, but it was an extra small, so I thought it would probably fit her. Brought it home, wrapped it up. She opens it on her birthday. She loves it. She thinks it's beautiful, wears it to church. It's awesome. Takes it off after church and comes down and says, Mom, yes? Mom, why does the tag on my birthday dress say Liz Lang Maternity? So don't be like the Wilkins. Probably not a good message to send to your 12-year-old daughter. Okay, it's obedience night. Jeff and I both know this is the night you all signed up for the class for.
Yeah. So, last week, we were broad, right? We stayed broad. We painted with big brush strokes. We looked into the Bible. We looked at what the Bible says about being parents, about raising children. I gave you a theology for parenting. And then we looked at just some guidelines that you can use to help you evaluate parenting advice, our class, books you read, videos you watch, people you talk to, those types of things. And then lastly, we talked about our families being the ultimate home group. This is a built-in group of people that you're with all the time. And frankly, a lot of the things that we want to take into our home group that we have with other adults are things that either already exist or should exist in our homes. And so we talked about how a home group is a group of people who want to share things together. They want to share life. They want to do life together. They want to share experiences. And so we came up with five things that we're going to talk through over the next couple weeks. And so we talked about sharing expectations. And so this week, we'll talk about obedience. And so that's an expectation. We'll talk about responsibilities next week. And so those are also expectations. And then the next week, we'll talk about language, so shared language. And then the week after that, we'll talk about how we share affection and time. And the last, we'll talk about how we share faith. And so this week is obedience. Why don't everybody turn to page 5 in your book? And so when we get there and we start filling in blanks, got a better clicker this week.
Yay!
So, all yay to the technology team. Woohoo! All right. So, turn to page 5. Okay, so we introduced this term last week, and we will continue to talk about this. So, we want to begin with the end in mind. And so someone grabbed me in class, and kind of like Jennifer said, was, okay, this is the week. The rubber meets the road in our house here. You've got to solve problems in the class today. Okay, and so we've got to parent for the long term. That's probably not going to happen. You're going to gain some things, but all your problems aren't going to be fixed tomorrow morning. So we've got to begin with the end in mind. So we want to parent for the long term. And so when we think about that, as it in regards to obedience, the question we ask is, when my children are adolescents, how do I want them to behave? Okay, so how do we want them to act? What do we want them to do? How do we want them to behave? And so last week we talked about how godly obedience wasn't just doing the right things, right? That we're doing the right things, but we also have the right motives. And so we want to keep that in mind as we talk about this, because it's not just about training your children to, you know, walk through the obstacle course of life, but that they can do it on their own because they're making good choices, because they have the right motives. And so we all know the stereotypical adolescent. Like, they're on TV shows all the time. It's the kid that's sneaky and is saying one thing and doing something else and is mouthy to their parents and, you know, lots of eye rolling and all those. I mean, everybody either knows that kid or seen him on TV. You know, everybody has that stereotype in mind. And so we don't want that, right?
Room is a mess, requires constant reminders, can't manage his own crud, and it's all your fault, right? Angry, we're not sure why. So we want to reassure you that your home doesn't have to look like that when you have adolescents. Our home doesn't look like that right now. Do we have days where we have a mouthy adolescent? We might, but it doesn't characterize their behavior, okay? And if we do, I certainly wouldn't call them out by name right now. So the stereotypical adolescent, you know, like Jeff said, you see them in the movies a lot. We kind of personally believe that kids get socialized a lot by those images and those types of media. And so that's something you might just want to keep an eye out for. If that expectation is never there for your child, a lot of that can go right past them. But sooner or later, they're going to meet that ratty kid at school and start acting like them. So you want to be sure that you are thinking, is that what I'm heading for, or do I want to head for something different? So let me just tell you one of those annoying stories like we heard in that first parenting class that we took. And just take my word for it, it's true. The last time we were on vacation at my parents' house out in New Mexico, we were having a big meal in the dining room. Our kids right now are 15, 14, 13, and 11, so that's basically all adolescents, right? And so the kids joined us for dinner. There were four people there who were not in our family. They were just guests who were invited to dinner that night. And so we finished the meal. We had all had polite conversation during dinner. The kids participated in the conversation. And then as the meal began to wind down and it was time for dessert and coffee, all four kids stood up, cleared away all of the plates that were on the table, put the plates into the dishwasher, and began serving dessert and coffee to the rest of us. And it was all that Jeff and I could do to not fall out of our chairs, because we couldn't believe it had happened. You know, we're trying to like cover our surprise and just act like, oh yeah, this is the way it is every night in our home. And so it was this really beautiful moment where we began to see the fruits of a lot of really hard work that has happened for years, because it wasn't that we had told them to do so. We didn't prep them. We have done that before. Before a meal, we've said, now listen, when the meal's over, why don't you clear everything away and load the dishwasher? But we didn't do it this time. They just got up and did it. They initiated an obedient and kind and polite act on their own, because the expectation had been set, not once, but a gazillion times over a number of years. And so it ended up, of course, it was a huge blessing to Jeff and me. But I have to tell you, my dad was calling me like a week later saying that the other couples that were there at the dinner kept saying, what was that? Did you pay them? You know, like they could not believe it. And so it was a huge example to us too of how if you raise children who end up taking in those values and they internalize those things and they make them their own, that it also is such a huge part of your witness. It's a way that the gospel speaks through your family. So that's a good thing to aim for. So, but that's long-term what it looks like. Now we have to talk about how you get there.
All right. So, so obedience matters. Our next question we want to throw out there is, why does early obedience matter? And so the key here is early in that sentence. It's hard to parent small children.
Can we get a witness on that? Yeah.
And so there are a lot of behaviors that kids will grow out of naturally. And so if you're out there and you've had multiple kids, you know that sometimes that some attitude, fit throwing or something, that they'll just grow out of it. But we want to be diligent to begin training early. And so there's really three things that early obedience kind of helps set the foundation for. The first is because it trains our children to obey their heavenly Father. And so, you know, your children's first exposure to God is going to be through you as parents. As fallen as it is, that's the way God set it up. So when we teach our children to, I'm going to use some words here, submit their wills. Okay, so they want to do, you know, we're all born selfish, and when we're little and we start to exercise our freedoms, it's all about me. You know, that's all, you know, I'm the number one person in my life, and I want to do whatever feels good, whatever I think is right. And so what we want to do is teach our children to submit their wills to us. And so as they're submitting their wills to us and obeying us, we're teaching them to obey God, because as adults, we have trouble submitting our will to our heavenly Father. So we're starting to set a pattern and give them some experience in this. Okay, so the second point is because it helps us desire a biblical community with our children, and we want to be around them. Sometimes home groups are people that just get thrown together, and I don't know if you've ever been in a home group with a person that just drives you crazy, and how much fun it is to come to home group. I don't know if you've ever been there, but we've been there. And so if you're going to have your home be the ultimate home group, you don't want half the people in the home group to just drive you insane, right? Because that doesn't make it the ultimate home group. It's like the evil home group. And so we want to enjoy being around our children. And so by teaching our children to obey early, then they're more pleasant to be around. And then the last piece is really, it's going to really underscore the early. And that is because moral development starts around age 1 and is set by age 10 or 11.
Okay, really let that hit you. Did you hear what was just said? Moral development starts around age 1 and you're done setting their moral framework by the time they're 10 or 11. Most parents are under the assumption that they have 18 years. But the reality of it is that you don't. You have about 10 or 11 years in which you're able to guide your child's moral development in such a way that they will view the world through a lens that reflects God's reality or their own made-up reality. That is not a long time. So if you are going to delay getting serious about obedience until your child is 5 or 6, you have already forfeited over half of the time that you have to have influence on that child's moral development. So it is critical that we start molding their moral framework at the point that it begins to form itself, and that is around age 1. So tonight, we're going to look at how this fits together for very young children, toddlers, and then for pre-K, and then for K through about age 9 or 10. So the thing that you have to understand with children is if their moral development starts when they're age 1, are you able to sit down with a 1-year-old and reason through the why of why they shouldn't do whatever the particular thing is that they're supposed to not do? No, you can't reason with a 1-year-old. You can try, it'll be comical, but they're, you know, like you're yakking, blah, 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 and they're hearing every 2 words that they understand. So say you're saying, honey, I don't want you to touch that because it's hot and it'll hurt you, and they're hearing hot, blah, 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 hurt, blah, 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 blah. They can't follow all that. So what we also need to understand about children developmentally is that children learn by doing. Okay, you and I, we're adults. We're not like this anymore. We want you to tell me why I should do something, and once I understand why to do it, then I will begin to do it. So take working out, for example. I want you to convince me that that matters. Incidentally, no one has done that for me yet, but go ahead and feel free to try. So you convince me of the benefits of it, or, you know, what is going to be great about it, and then I will pursue that action. But children are not like that. Children's development is different, and they learn by doing. And so that means that in a child, right actions actually precede right motives. I'll give you an example of how this works. Just the most simple recurring example that we kept thinking of as we were talking through this is with apologizing when a child does something wrong. Okay, as soon as a child has the verbal skill to say, I'm sorry, that's when you start having them do that when they have done something wrong. And so you train them to say, I'm sorry, long before they feel sorry at all. Have you ever had a child apologize for something and you're like, they really hate my guts right now? They are not sorry even a little bit. Sorry will come at some point. The feelings will attach themselves to the words. But if you wait to have them say the words until the feelings are there, it's going to be way harder to train them in the habit of saying, I'm sorry. So that is an example of where you train them in the right action long before they're able to attach the correct motives to it, because it's in their best interest. And they will, over time, they'll come to see. When I say I'm sorry, there's restoration there. I want that. And if I'm sorry is the way to get to that, then I want that because I want restoration with my mom and dad, or I want restoration with my sibling. Okay. All right.
Okay, so early obedience matters. We can't just say children obey and then happens, right? We've got to train them in that. And so they are not going to obey a lot. And so we have to assign some consequences when they don't obey. And so what we want to do is spend a minute talking about the differences between punishment and discipline. And so everybody who's in favor of using punishment, discipline. All right, discipline. Yay. Okay, yay, we've been paying attention. So what we want, this is what we want. We want discipline. And so let's talk about the differences between the two. So punishment has the connotations of retribution or suffering. Oh, sorry. And so when we punish children, we're doing it to even the score. It has this connotation of you've wronged me as the parent and now you're going to pay. And so we don't want to punish that way. You know, we don't want to punish at all. We don't want to be punishing, because what happens when you're punishing and trying to even the score is that the parent ends up controlling the child. And so what ends up happening here is you're parenting out of fear. you're instilling fear in your child. And so your child is going to be afraid of some response you're going to have. And that is what is going to motivate them to not do a particular action or to obey. They're going to obey you out of fear because they're going to be afraid they're going to be punished.
So you'll get this outward obedience if you parent out of fear, if you're using punishment. You'll get a good response from an outward standpoint, but you're getting it for the wrong reasons. And here's the issue. If you're dealing with a system that the result is that the parent controls the child, what happens when the child turns 18 and leaves your home? And now that parental control is gone, and you know this kid, right? Goes to college and is like, mommy, daddy, no longer here, and there's some fun to be had. And they begin to question and reevaluate everything that they learned under the control of this parent who used punishment, and it was getting even and it was personal instead of about something bigger than that. So in contrast to that, what we're after is discipline. While punishment is about retribution and suffering, discipline, by contrast, is about training and correcting. Training and correcting. And the end result of discipline is not that the parent controls the child, it's that the child controls the child. Do you see it? So we give the child an internal mechanism for making good choices instead of just setting up a framework where we're making all the choices for them. And if they screw up, they're going to pay. So the parent, rather than controlling the child, sets the child up to learn how to control himself.
So this is really reflected in the way God parents us as well, because this is sanctification for your child. God has punished Christ on our behalf. That's no longer there. And so when God parents us, he's using discipline and grace, and he's giving us expectations. And when we fail, he's going to, you know, there's going to be consequences for that failure, or he's going to take us through trials to teach us the right way to interface with him, how to be good Christians, to conform us to Christ's likeness. And so we can take that model and see it, that we are part of the sanctification of our children as well.
So, you want to carry this next
sure.
section through?
And so we're parenting for the long run, with parenting with the end in mind. And so what should obedience look like in the long run? Okay. We want our children to obey us the way we obey God, right? And so coming out of this sanctification idea, we want joyful obedience out of gratitude. And so we want our children to learn that we're going to interface with them gracefully. We're going to be teaching them, and it's just not arbitrary punishment. And so opposed to that would be that they are obeying us out of grudging obedience out of fear. And so punishment's going to instill the grudging obedience out of fear, where discipline is going to build in joyful obedience out of gratitude.
And I think that story I shared with you a little bit ago about on vacation when the kids just stood up and did the right thing, they got a lot of joy out of that. They really enjoyed. They knew that we were trying not to freak out that it had actually happened. And it was funny. It was a funny story later when we talked about it. And so it was just nice to kind of see that it does actually come around in the end. So we talked last week a little bit about yes, mom, no, mom, yes, dad, no, dad, and that whole idea of balancing law and grace. This is going to be critical when it comes to obedience. I'm going to sort of blaze through these scripture references, and if you want to take time to look at them later when you're home, you can. This first one, Exodus 24, 3-7, is a story where Moses gives the law to the people of Israel, and he reads the entire book of the law to them, and he says, "Will you obey these things?" And they all go, "Yes, we will obey everything you have read to us." And so then he goes through a ceremony and he says again, "Will you obey everything?" And they say, "We will. Like, we can't wait to get started. We're the most obedient people ever." You know how that story goes, right? Do you think for a second that Moses doesn't know what's going to happen? He's already spent some time with these people. They started grumbling about the food as soon as they got out of sight of Egypt. So he knows that they are saying, "Yes, we will do everything," but they're not going to. And you know what he does? He sprinkles them with blood. He sprinkles the blood that is symbolic of the atoning work of Christ on these people who have not broken the law yet. Why? Because he knows they will. Okay? It's a picture of this readiness to extend grace before grace is even necessary. And that's going to be something you're going to want to hang on to as a parent. I'm going to flesh that out in just a second. The other verse, Romans 5, 20-21, listen to the balancing in this verse of these ideas of law and grace, okay? In verse 20, it says, "Now the law came to increase the trespass." And that just means that, in other words, the law pointed out that we were sinners, okay? The law came to increase the trespass, but where sin increased, what? Grace abounded all the more, so that as sin reigned in death, grace also might reign through righteousness, leading to eternal life through Christ Jesus our Lord. We have to balance law with grace. So here's how you handle this as a parent. You are going to be responsible to set the standard, expecting that it will not be met. Okay, now I'm not saying that you say, "Okay, I'm expecting you to keep your room clean. I know you're going to blow it." You're not going to say that to your kids, but you're going to say, "I'm expecting you're going to keep your room clean." You, the parent, know there's no way that room's going to stay clean. You don't communicate that to your child, but you prepare your heart for the day, probably the next day, when you walk into that room and it is not clean. Because at that point, you have to be prepared to offer grace for failure. Home needs to be a safe place for your children to fail. It doesn't mean that they get away with everything. It means that you assign a consequence, but then there is grace there for restoration. Okay? So you set the standard expecting that it will not be met, and you are prepared to offer grace for failure. When your children fail to hit the mark, it is not a personal offense against you. It's all part of the training. And the more that you take it personally, the more wacky your parenting is going to be. Here's what the no mom is going to do, okay? Or the no dad. The no mom, she fears a loss of control. That's her fear. So she's throwing the rules out there. You got to obey the rules. And so she's going to tend to withhold grace when the rules are broken. And then you've got the yes mom on the other side of that. What is her fear? She fears that there will be loss of relationship if she toes the line. So what's she going to do? She's going to withhold the law. She's going to try to give as few rules as possible that have to be obeyed, because then there's as little conflict as possible and we can all hang out and just love each other a whole lot. So you have to know kind of where you're coming from. We're all called to set the standard, and we're all called to extend grace when grace is necessary. So now we're going to take a look at just a basic pattern for training obedience.
Okay,
you have
so,
a diagram in your book.
Yeah, and so when we use the word pattern on purpose, because you know, this is going to end up being this little script that you go through. Children like consistency, right? They like repetition. Your kids ever watch the same video over and over and over? And it doesn't matter.
It's still funny. Like, it's still funny.
You know, it's just like, oh, do we have to watch it again? Yeah, it's the best movie ever. You know, they like things that they know. They like the predictability because the predictability for them feels safe. It's like, I know how this is going to go, and I feel safe in this. Even in the scenario here we're going to go through where it may not go well, at least I know as the child how it's going to go. And so there's predictability. So that's why this is a pattern. So.
Okay, so, and you really do. You want it to be almost a scripted thing as that child is growing up so that they know what comes next in this little play that we call obedience. And there are a couple of paths that it could go on. I'm going to give an example to walk us through this little pattern here, and it's going to be for a slightly older child. I'm going to do it for, like a child who is about 4 years old. The whole idea of setting the expectation, really, the whole toddler to two is where you're setting that expectation. You're setting it in ways that we'll talk about when we get a little further on. You're obviously not going to turn to your 18-month-old before you walk into the grocery store and say, I do not want any fits today in the grocery store. That would be pointless. But there are ways that you can head towards that with that 18-month-old. We'll talk about that in a little bit. So bear in mind, I'm talking here about a slightly older child. So let's say that you have a new puppy in your home. And here comes we'll make it a three-year-old. Here comes the three-year-old, and the three-year-old's very excited about the puppy. And so now you're going to set the expectation. You turn to the three-year-old and you say, Susie, use a gentle touch with the puppy. Okay, Susie? And what does Susie do? La, 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 la. And you say, answer mommy. Okay, mom. Okay. Okay, mom. Okay, mom. Great, now let's touch the puppy. So now, in your world, I hope what happens is that Susie then uses a gentle touch with the puppy. And you say to Susie, thank you, Susie. That is good. Very gentle. You are very big. Thank you for touching the puppy with gentle hands, right? And then you've offered praise and affirmation to the obedient child. And then maybe later on that night at dinner when Dad comes home, you can tell Dad in front of Susie, you should have seen Susie with the puppy. She used a gentle touch. It was great. Okay, so you've gone through the cycle, the good side. Set the expectation, child obeys, you offer praise and affirmation, and then a teachable moment after you're in the middle of it, and you come back and reinforce what has happened. So now let's talk about the dark side of Susie. You set the expectation, and then Susie picks up the puppy and begins to shake it like a sack of flour and is trying to gouge its eyes out. And so then what do you do? You get a new puppy. No, you say, you remove Susie from the puppy, right? You assign a consequence. You say, no more puppy this afternoon. I'm so sorry. What did mom ask you to do? Gentle touch. What did you do? Shook the puppy. Yes. So what do you need to say to mom? I'm sorry I shook the puppy. Thank you. I forgive you. And I appreciate that you have apologized. We still cannot touch the puppy for the rest of the day, okay? Okay, Mom. And so then, later that night at dinner, you might circle back around and say, tomorrow we're going to have a chance to play with the puppy again. What should you do tomorrow when you play with the puppy? Gentle touch. Yeah, that's right. That's really good. Okay, do you see what I'm saying? So we have this cycle. It's like a little script. Susie does not want to apologize, but she knows that that's what comes next in the play, okay? And at some point, Susie begins to become the character that she is playing. It's a beautiful thing. Okay, so.
It does happen.
It does happen.
Okay, so.
And hopefully the puppy lives too.
Right. So in the middle there, we had to assign a consequence when your child was disobedient. So let's spend a little bit of time talking about assigning consequences. Okay.
This is what you've all been waiting for.
Dun, dun, dun.
Give me some ammo, baby.
All right. Consequences.
Just hug them a lot.
Consequences should humble, not humiliate. Consequences should humble, not humiliate. And so humiliation is kind of tied to that idea of punishment as well. There's a little bit of retribution getting back there, where we really want to train and discipline. We want them to feel the weight of their disobedience, and the consequence should reflect that, but in a teachable, trainable way. So when we think about ways that we can humiliate our children.
Let's think about that for a few minutes.
Just so we know. So if you mock your child or ridicule your child for failure, so what would that look like?
Well, so like say the child is carrying their drink over to the table and they drop their drink and they start to cry. And you go, well, okay, cry baby, come on, let's go sit down.
Yeah.
Not funny. You know, all that does is make that child just burn on the inside. And you know what? Probably the best way to think about this, think back to your own childhood. Think about a time when you felt humiliated instead of humbled. Maybe you had great parents who never humiliated you. Then think about middle school, okay? Think about what that feels like. And any time that you are trying to, and a lot of times with children, most of us are not going to do something physically humiliating to our child, and so it's probably going to be a verbal attack on our part. And we're going to talk a lot about this in a few weeks when we talk about communication. Yeah, you have the upper hand verbally on your child. Right. Be the adult. Don't play that card.
Yeah.
Okay? It's not fair.
So
it's
other
bullying.
So other things like bringing up past failures. Oh my gosh, you always drop your milk, you know. Or retelling the child's past failures to others. Every time she walks through here, she drops her cup of milk, and the child is hearing you say these things. This is humiliating your child. Or using contemptuous language or gestures like, seriously? Are you kidding me? You dropped your milk again?
You have to hear the implied thought behind that. Seriously?
Yeah.
Like, I know it's a really cute thing to say right now. Seriously? Are you kidding me? Really? But what you're really saying is, are you really that stupid?
Yeah.
Let's be honest. That's what that phrase means. So say it to me and I'll laugh, but don't say it to your child. Because your child can't pick up the nuance. All they hear is, I'm stupid. Mom thinks I'm dumb.
Yeah. And so just a couple, like, correcting your child in front of others is like playing out this whole game. I mean, you're going to be out in public, and we'll talk about that and some tips for that. But going through the whole game just right out in the middle of the group of their friends or in front of other parents could be humiliating for your child. And the last thing we came up with was spanking your child when they're too old. You know, it's just carrying that out. So
I know what you're thinking. Seriously, are they ever too old? Because
right.
It feels right to me. It still feels right. Yeah, I know.
But spanking your fifth grader is more about humiliating them than it is about humbling them.
Yeah.
And so we're not really teaching at that point. We're making an example of them.
We're making ourselves feel really good
and
not doing much for them.
Yeah, and so the key... Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the other thing, too, is that whole not being careful to as much as possible to give correction in private. That includes if you have siblings there. As much as you can, don't correct a child in front of a sibling. That sets up all kinds of bad stuff, okay? So you can honor their personhood. You can honor their dignity just by saying, would you come back in the other room with me? Plus, it'll scare the pants off of the other kids. They're like, what is she going to do? And they never know what happens in that room. Do you remember, like, in the first grade? Well, at least when I was in the first grade, they had a closet where they paddled people. And I was like, I don't know what happens in there. I'm never going in that closet. It's the same idea. I did actually go in that closet, but
Uh-oh. That's
a story for another night.
Okay, so you want to humble your children. So isolating the child for throwing a fit teaches them that they're not the center of attention. So it's taking them out of the center and humbling them. So that's an appropriate way of an appropriate consequence. Or teaching the child to verbally acknowledge their sin, to confess their sin and apologize.
Mm-hmm.
Is a consequence for them that humbles them. And really, that's a great place to insert God into the parenting equation. It's like, you know, God knows what you did. God knows that you lied, you know, and it's not just that you've, you know, done something against mom and dad, but you've sinned against God as well. And so start making that connection a little bit at a time as you go along. And I think it really helps you, really helps your child to think about their life and where God fits into it in a bigger way.
Okay. We're at just a little end in mind point here. We're at a really cool point now with the kids where, like, we had some sibling friction last week, and one of the people involved came to me and said, you know, my sister is doing this, this, and this. It's really making me nuts, and I just want to respond in this way. And I was able to say to her, well, what is your conscience clear on this? Like, is there anything that you need to ask her forgiveness on? Is there anything you need to ask God's forgiveness on before you address the issue that you have with her? And she took that to heart, and she, you know, had to really think about that and pray about it. And before, you know, 2 seconds later, here comes the other one. She's doing this, and blah, blah, blah. And I was able to ask her the same question. She went through the same evaluation process. So we're to a point now where we don't have to say, you did this wrong, now go say this to your sister. It's where they're now managing the conflict themselves, and they're owning up to their own role of sin, sinful behavior in those situations. So.
Okay.
But it took a lot of these next things to get us there.
All right, yeah. So, no anger, yelling, sighing, raising your voice, using a contemptuous tone, not from your child, but from you.
Those are all power plays on the part of an adult. Those are all skills that you have, ways to elevate yourself above the child rather than to deal with them fairly and in a way that's respectful. So let's talk about some ways that we can deal with them in ways that are beneficial. And I'm going to move through these pretty quickly, because when we get to the whole end where we're talking about obedience through the day, we're going to talk about applying some of this more. So when your child is very young, so we're talking 9 months to 24 months, there are very few tools in the arsenal. Am I right? There's just not that many. You can't really sit down and talk them through what happened or any of that. And so you have to rely a lot on two main things. The first one is timeout or separation. Everybody's probably familiar with this. And this is great for many behaviors, because this is all about, there are so many things that a child does between the ages of 9 months and 24 months that are just about getting in your view, right? They'll do something good, they'll do something bad, just so they can focus your attention on them. And so that's why this is such a great thing, because you say basically to the child, if you can obey, you and I can be together. If you can't obey, you need to go spend some time away from me. Okay? And it doesn't mean you lose fellowship with me. The child knows that they're not going to be left in the room until they're 25. But it means that I set boundaries on how much of this behavior I'm willing to be in the room with. Okay? So timeout, separation, fantastic. I think spanking, and we're going to talk about that now, that spanking, it's almost too easy. Okay? For some people, it's all they've got. And spanking is something that you should really consider using judiciously, because for one thing, you may get that child who you spank him and he just gives you that grunt and looks at you like, that all you got, lady? And then what are you going to do? But in my experience, I've had both kinds of children. I've had the children where you like hold up the little spanky stick and they go, ah, you know, I just don't, please, I love you, I'm sorry. And then there's that kid who's like, bring it, what do you got? And then you spank him and they're like, okay, what's next? You know, and you're like, do I just keep doing this? This is insane. But in both cases, I have not met a child who doesn't hate being isolated. They hate it. They may not hate it at first. And I did have one who kind of hated it, but he was kind of like, great, I'll just sit here and sing songs, or I'll kick the door, or I'll yell stuff or whatever. And so we had to come up with another form of isolation, and that was the stool. And I took one of those little step stools, you know, like you use when you're brushing your teeth, and I would set it in the middle of a room that was out of eyesight, but where I could walk in at any time, and he had to stand on the stool, and he wasn't allowed. And so, and if you yell, you stay on the stool longer. If you try to get my attention in any way, you stay on the stool longer. You know, I'd set the timer. If you get off the stool, guess what? You stay on the stool longer. So it added just a little level of physical discomfort and limit of range of motion to the idea of isolation. And it was sheer genius. It was a gift from the Lord. It came to me one night in a dream. I offer it to you now. So timeout and separation. Try to think before you go to spanking, ask if it's something that you could deal with timeout. Okay? So then we do have spanking in the arsenal. Now, it is commonly agreed among not just child care professionals, but even people within the Christian community who, you know, everybody thinks if you're a Christian giving child care advice that you're like, spank them as soon as you can. But that's actually not the case. What the general consensus is that you wait to spank until a child is two. Okay? Now, children can put themselves in plenty of dangerous situations prior to turning two. So you're going to have to really think about how you can get that immediate, you know, this is not safe, response without spanking. Now, I'll be honest with you, there were times when we spanked before the age of two, but it's really best to restrict that to this child has done something extremely dangerous and needs to know right then that mom and dad are in charge, okay? The earlier you start spanking, the less effective it might be at some point. And if you spank consistently for the appropriate things, you should be done spanking by the time your child is about age five. You should be done with it, because you'll have so many other options by the time they're age five that you won't even need to use it anymore. So spanking, I like to say that we do spanking for the double D's. Actually, I'm going to give you the triple D's tonight because I thought of another one. The first is danger, okay? So if a child runs out in the street, that's a spank. Something where they might harm themselves or they might harm someone else, that's a spank. And then the second thing is for defiance, okay? Now, I don't mean, sometimes a kid will say something and you're like, was that defiant or not? You know, there's always kind of this gray area. You know what I'm talking about, where you've just said don't do something and that child turns around and is like, oh, watch me, ooh, you know, that kind of thing. That can, it doesn't have to be a spank, but that's a good reason to spank. So again, ask yourself, is there a way to deal with this in another way? So danger and defiance. And then the third D, as they get older, that I love to employ spanking for is destruction. If a child is willfully destroying property just for the sheer enjoyment of it, and you know that they know they have the control not to, that can be a reason to spank as well. So the beauty of it is that they begin to outgrow spanking as they grow into another kind of consequence or two, and those are natural and logical consequences. Natural and logical consequences as the child gets older. So an example of a natural consequence is you willfully destroy your new Lego set, and we don't replace it. Gosh, I'm sorry that happened.
I don't think you can destroy Lego.
Okay, what would be it? Okay, how about this? This was a great example he gave because I sort of have a dark history of running over toys in the driveway. So he said, you know, when the child leaves the toy out and doesn't put it away, and mom runs over it with the minivan that had the rake dragged down the side, gosh, I'm sorry. Didn't you just learn a lesson about leaving your toys out? That's a natural consequence. So then a logical consequence is where the consequence is somehow related to what the offense was. So the way this typically happens at our house is, say you leave a responsibility undone, you get to now do that responsibility plus six or seven more. No, I'm just kidding. I would say, you didn't make your bed, I asked you to make your bed, now you get to make your bed and unload the dishwasher for me. Okay. And then if they don't do that, you know, you just give them something else and they start accruing this list of things. Now you have to, you know, you have to have in place an understanding that those things happen, or you may just be adding up misery for yourself, but hopefully that will not be the case. Okay, so.
All right. So the how and why of setting expectations. So we talked about the consequence, and we had to go back to the beginning and setting the expectation, how to set good expectations. And so we're going to jump through some really just different age groups and everything. And so what we want to do is say no as little as possible. And so what we want to do is find ways to state the boundaries in positive terms. So what does that mean? Well, one of the big reasons is if you say no to your child a lot, they're going to say no back to you. You say no all the time, they're going to say no back to you. And so how can we avoid this, you know, no scenario? Plus, this kind of goes into as we start to look through these, you'll start to see that we can very early start to teach children reasons for things without having to go, now the reason that you don't run in the street is, you know. And so when we look at, for a toddler, we say things like stop or danger, gentle touch, not yours. So the danger, we start to associate things. And so I'm giving them a reason while I'm not just saying, no, don't run in the street. You know, I'm saying danger. I'm saying stop. And so when they're little, well, are we going to talk about the physical side to all this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we will. We'll get to that in a little bit.
All right. So then when you have a pre-K, the idea is, you know, you want to say sit nicely as opposed to will you stop wiggling? Will you please sit nicely? And so now we're using a positive tone because we want a positive tone to come back from our child as well. And so it also helps you limit the contemptuous language that will come out of your mouth if you think about being positive. And so, speaking of elementary school, we want to say, will you please change your tone? as opposed to, will you stop that whining? So these are just some examples of being positive and using words other than just no or stop. Okay. All right.
You're pushing them towards a positive behavior. You're not just telling them to stop a negative one. That's kind of what you're doing there.
And you can see, you know, how what they're able to understand is greater. And so the number of words you use are greater as well. So,
one of the things that I see a lot, like when moms are asking me for help with what do I do with my toddler, is there is so much dialogue going on with the toddler. You know, the toddler is doing something horrid and the mom's like, honey, don't touch that baby. You need to come over here by mommy. Honey, I don't want you to touch that because you might get hurt. And the baby is not catching any of that. He's like, oh, mom is making eye contact and talking to me. This is fantastic. And you end up with doing the opposite of what you want to do. And I hate to say this. We had this funny conversation. Think of your toddler like a dog. If you were training a dog, you only use one word commands. The dog learns that one word because your child does not have the ability to understand sentences really and process all that until they're about age 3. And you should have done a lot of parenting by that point. So give these simple one or two word commands, not because that you're actually valuing them at their developmental level and giving them tools that they can use instead of just bah, 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 and they're like, she loves me. She really loves me. No.
Okay, the next thing is our goal with setting expectations is we want to take back as few freedoms as possible. And so we want to choose to grant freedoms at age-appropriate times. And so
So the classic example here, by choosing to grant freedoms at age-appropriate times, you're going to save yourself a world of trouble. So let's talk about what happens if you're too slow to grant a freedom. If you're too slow to grant a freedom, you're going to create frustration in the child. So let me just give you an example. You have a 5-year-old, and there's a child who lives 3 houses down in your neighborhood. He wants to go over and knock on the door and see if the child can play. And you say, I'm going to need you to come hold your hand, and we're going to go over, and I'll stand behind you while you knock on the door. Okay. He's old enough to walk 3 houses down. Now, I'm all for you hiding in the shrub and watching him the whole way down there, but he's old enough to do that. Or say your 5th grader wants to ride his bike a 1/4 mile to the elementary school, and you don't want to give him that response. You know, you don't want to hand that to him, but he's old enough, and he's going to know that, especially in the 5th grade, because he's got friends who are riding 2 miles to school. And so when you don't do that, he becomes frustrated, and it's going to undermine his self-confidence at some point. He's going to think you don't think he can handle those kinds of responsibilities. So now let's look at the flip side of this. If you're too quick to grant freedoms. Now, you can already see the correspondence here between yes, mom, no, mom, yes, dad, no, dad, right? The no mom tends to be too slow to grant freedoms. And the yes, dad, he's like, yeah, you're sure, it's all yours. Here's the most common freedom that I see granted too quickly to children today. And this is the small child and the electronics, okay? So, namely, usually it's the cell phone, the iPhone. And so you see the 1.5-year-old who has the iPhone and they're watching a show on at the grocery store, or maybe they're paging through there, they're playing some Angry Birds or whatever on your phone. I don't even know if a 1.5-year-old can play that. I have a flip phone. So, you're fine with this kid holding on to your iPhone. He's your kid. But then he comes over to my house and he sees mine hanging out of my purse. And what's he going to do? Ooh, game time. Runs over and picks up my phone. And then you have to stop him because you know you can't let your 1.5-year-old play with my electronics because he doesn't have $350 to buy me a new one. And so at that point, you have to say, no, baby, put the phone back. And what's that child going to do? He's going to explode. And he has a right to because you've set a wrong expectation for him. You've given him something that he's not old enough to have. And so now you're in trouble. But the other point is just that he wasn't ready for it yet. And so you end up, the child feel, this is a very young child example, but there are examples for kids who are older, and you can probably think of some of them in your head. You're too quick to grant the freedoms, and then the child feels entitled to whatever it was that you had granted them. They feel entitled to more freedoms because they think, well, gosh, if I hit her up for a cell phone in the 3rd grade and she said yes, who knows? Sky's the limit. And then on top of that, they're angry when you have to pull back because you realize that you've made a mistake and granted something too soon. Don't get me wrong, you should still pull back when you realize that you've done something too soon, but be prepared because their frustration and their anger over that is actually understandable and pretty much your fault. So just let me add to your parenting guilt right now. But like I said, do the right thing. Keep moving forward. You know, you can tell them, Mom, Dad made a mistake. We shouldn't have done that yet. We make mistakes too. Can you forgive me? You sure? Give me the phone back. Okay, so too slow, frustration in the child, too quick, entitlement and anger. So do your best to judge, is this an age-appropriate time for the child to have a particular freedom?
Okay, so expectations should be set and acknowledged face-to-face and with eye contact.
This is a hard one, especially if you live in a two-story house, because yes, you want to yell, Johnny, it's time to go. Come on down here. And it just gets ridiculous. And you've got the child yelling back at you, you know, and then it's like, oh, well, I didn't hear you. I was just kind of playing with my stuff up here. So you have to develop this idea that we always acknowledge face-to-face with eye contact. So we're going to do a little role play for you, okay? Jeff is going to be a two-year-old. He's going to be a two-year-old, and we're just going to walk through what this looks like. Now, Jeffy is about to walk towards something that is breakable, and he is going to attempt to touch it. So that's what he's doing right now. And I say, Jeffy, stop. Now, here's the deal. Jeffy started walking towards dangerous things way younger than this. And so the first time I asked Jeffy to stop, do you think he stopped? Heck no. So what did I have to do? I had to get my lazy self up off of the chair, and I had to go over to Jeffy and say, Jeffy, stop. And physically stop him. And then do you know what I said? Good boy. Did Jeffy do anything? No, he was physically restrained by me, but it doesn't matter because you are teaching him that when you say stop, he needs to stop. And so he's learning by doing, okay? So you say, Jeffy, stop. And he begrudgingly stops, okay? And then I say, look at mommy. And what's he gonna do? So then at the first, in the earliest stages, what do I have to do? I have to say, look at mommy. And then I have to get down in his range of vision and establish eye contact. And then I'm going to say again, good boy. He has not been the least bit good. It doesn't matter. You're training him the script to the play, okay? So he's a little older now, so we don't have to go through all of that. So here he goes. He's heading for something dangerous. And I say, Jeffy, stop. He freezes. And I say, look at mom. Now, they're still Weasley about this. So you can say, look at mommy's eyes. They can never resist that. And then they'll like me. And I said, thank you. No touch. I don't want you to touch that, okay? Now, I need a verbal response from Jeffy, and I'm not getting it, right? So I say, I give him the verbal response. Okay, mom.
Okay.
Okay, mom.
Okay, mom.
Thank you. Okay, so did you hear what just happened? Now, in the South, a lot of times people don't want okay, mom. They want yes, ma'am. That didn't fit at our house, but it might fit at yours. The point is that they need to, and here's what just happened there, is that little Jeffy, when he establishes eye contact with me and gives me a verbal response, what has just happened? I just won the battle before he ever got into the battlefield. Because when they acknowledge and respond, they've submitted their will to you already. And so that's what you want to do. You want to get that, we've made eye contact, you've acknowledged, you've heard me. Because now if Jeffy goes and does that, he's not just defiant, he looks like a dum-dum. And kids don't like that. And the thing is that kids are not dumb. But what we want to tell ourselves is that either we treat them either like they're deaf or like they're stupid. Don't we? But here's the thing. They're not either of those things. And how can you know that? Because if you said to little Jeffy, Jeffy, would you like a cookie? How quickly would it take little Jeffy to come over to your side? He understands exactly what you're wanting to communicate, but he's deciding whether he's going to submit his will to yours or not. Now, if you want to give him a cookie, heck yeah, he's going to submit his will to yours right away. And if he can give first time response to a command like that, then he can do it for another command as well, even if it's something that he doesn't want to do. Carl and I had a long discussion about this, how people don't believe you when you say that first time obedience is possible for your children, but it is. It is absolutely possible. And the way that you start to see the importance of it is with these safety issues, you know, where there's literally the child's safety is at stake. So, you know, I've had instances, we have a pool in our backyard, people bring their small children over, and I can't tell you how many times I've heard a mom say, now, Susie, don't go over by the step, that's not safe. And what does Susie do? okay. And then she walks over and she sits in the water on the top step. Oh, honey, I told you not to do that. Come on over here. Yeah, she heard you. You know, and so what you have to set it up so that you have a way to fix that problem where you say, if you go over there again, what will happen? You know, if you go over there again, we're going home, okay? Okay, mommy. Okay, mommy. And she has to acknowledge that she's heard the warning. And then if she goes over and she gets in again, you got to have the guts to go home. She needs to know that you mean business. Don't worry about offending your neighbor. Your neighbor's probably going to be high-fiving you for not having your child fall into a pool again. Okay? And remember, you're not responsible for managing other people's expectations of you. You're responsible for stewarding well the little talents that God has given you. So you need to understand you should give the same number of warnings as the number of times you want your children to consistently disobey. Don't play that game. They're not deaf and they're not stupid. You should be able to say it once and get a response from them. And if you don't, then there's a consequence. And so it doesn't mean, and remember, we're talking about balancing law and grace. And so you have to weigh the situation and ask yourself, is this a time to extend grace? But if your pattern is to extend grace instead of giving the consequence too much, you'll begin to know because the child won't respond the first time. So we're going to take a look. It's 8:07. What should we do here?
I don't know. Are we going to punt?
We can talk through. We have a little extra time built into next week. We have some Q&A to cover. So I think what I'd like to do.
Do the Q&A there.
What do you want to do?
Do this next week with the questions and just fit it in together.
Okay, because what we could do is go through the toddler stuff tonight and save the older stuff for later.
Okay.
And then go to the Q&A with Carl. Is that okay? All right, Carl's giving me the thumb ups.
Okay.
Thumbs up. Okay, so obedience through the day. Go ahead.
All right, so we're going to jump in here and talk about some things. Jennifer's going to do a lot of talking.
Really fast.
Really fast. So I want you to hear me say, dads, you either err on one of two sides here with the situation. Okay, you are the leader in your home, okay? And so you've got to set the direction and you're going to be held accountable for it. You've got to be on the same team as your wife here. And so dads are either too involved in the discipline process, meaning that everything gets put off until dad gets home. And so you're missing teaching and disciplining, you know, opportunities during the day because things get put off for dad. Or they're not involved enough. And so everything is on mom. And mom may even choose to push you away. And so either one of those extremes are not good. What I want you to hear me say is, you're the head coach. So we're going to use sports. You're the head coach. You're setting the direction for your home. But you have a job. Most of you do, hopefully. And you're off earning a living, providing for your family. You are being a father doing that role. God's called you to do it. But you've hired a really good offensive coordinator. Okay? And so
I don't even know what that is, but I love this analogy.
You don't have time to know the ins and outs of the offense. You know that we're running the spread or the wishbone, whatever it is that we're running. We know that this person is really good at that. And so you're going to have a game plan. You're going to talk it all through and you're going to have it all mapped out on how all this works. But this is the person when the game comes that's going to be calling the plays and executing the offense during the week. Your offensive coordinator may get suspended for a game because of yelling at the referees or something. So, Dad, it doesn't exempt you from knowing the offense. You've got to know enough of the offense. And so your challenge as the head coach is to keep up with enough of the offense because as a parent, 1 month you're running the run and shoot and the next run you're running the wishbone and then you're back to the run and shoot because the rules change because your children's age has changed. We've just talked about all these different scenarios. And so you got to kind of be in contact with mom and knowing what rules apply today. And so moms, you've got to help. You can't be going, well, I'm leaving these kids. I'm going out of town with the girls for this weekend. And that son of a gun is going to see how hard it is. So that's what you want to avoid. So mom's got to set dad up to succeed. So you got to be feeding him information. And dad, you can't be off the hook. You've got to be garnering the information here. But the mom is the one who's executing the offense. So all that said.
Yeah, moms, you should be able to leave and he pick up flawless, maybe not flawlessly, but he should be able to step in and feel confident in his role. And in fact, when you do leave him for a couple days, he gets really confident in his role. house may be a little bit of a wreck when you get home, but it's worth it. Okay, so I'm just going to cover the toddler portion tonight, and we'll save the rest for next time, but it'll sort of start pointing you in the direction of what next week is going to look like, and we'll cover the rest of these obedience issues next week. We're not going to cover all of your obedience questions. Silly people. That's not what this class was for. But as I mentioned, you know, we talked about how with the older child, you set the expectation before you get into the situation, and then, you know, you're more prepared to go through it successfully. And so the way that those expectations end up getting set, it starts with this toddler, this 9 to 24 month, where you're setting the expectations in your own home as a process so that when you are out somewhere else, the child knows, okay, this doesn't fly at home, so it's not going to fly here. So let's talk about mealtime very quickly. Now, you always have to be thinking short-term versus long-term. We talked about this last time. Mealtime for a child ages 9 to 24 months is not always fun, neat, or clean. And so a lot of times they don't want to eat what you've served them, that kind of thing. And so what you need to bear in mind is when you're thinking short-term, you want to fill their tummy with whatever you can get them to eat, right? So you'll feed them macaroni until they're 15. If that is what you, so you can check off, okay, I fed the child. I may have not got anything else done today, but I fed the child. But long-term is I need to train my child to have self-control at the table and to have good eating habits, okay? So rule number one, no throwing. Throwing is so fun, but not when they're at my house instead of your house, okay? So when a child throws, children who are really hungry to eat don't throw food. They don't. And when a child throws food, you can be pretty sure that they've had enough to eat. And so when your child chunks the bowl, and they will, onto the floor, you can say, all done, no throwing. And then you can give grace that first time, put the bowl back, right? And then the child eyeballs you, picks it up, chunks it again, and you go, all done. And then they know, oh man, if I chunk that bowl, this game is over, okay? And so it's not going to happen great the first time, but the point is that you don't let them repeatedly throw the bowl on the floor, make a mess everywhere. It's better if you have a dog. I've learned that as an adult. Okay, so the idea, again, thinking long-term, self-control at the table outside of your home. So I have to train them to behave inside my home the way I would want them to behave outside of my home. So if you will fight the battle of eat what you are served early, it will be so much easier than if you wait to do it when your child is 5 or 6. Your pediatrician will tell you that your child can refuse a meal and will not starve himself and will not suffer any kind of long-term effects. If he does that, that he'll come back, show up for breakfast, ready to eat the next morning. And so just bear in mind that you can start with, and give them 2 or 3 options. Pick one you know they don't want and set that on there with 2 that you know they do want, so you know they're getting some food, but you're offering them something that they might not otherwise eat, and you're going to offer it to them repeatedly so that they get used to seeing it on the plate and they eventually try it. If they refuse the whole meal, it's on you to resist the urge to give them a snack. Because you're going to feel like, oh, you know, especially if you're the yes mom, you're like, I didn't do my job today. But you are doing your job. And I know this is hard. But if you are going to think about, do I want to be the mom who fixes 4 different meals for 4 different kids? No, that's like a recipe for insanity, okay? And here's another thing that you have to think about. We have a very Western mentality about children and food. If you lived in a third world country, your child would eat whatever was placed in front of them. And so just because we have a lot of options around here doesn't mean that we have to feed our children macaroni and hot dogs all of the time, okay? Because if they only had fewer options and they were healthy options, eventually they would learn to eat them. So, you know, don't buy into the lie, oh, he doesn't like that. You can train children to like things that are good for them. It takes a long time and it's hard. And I still have a 14-year-old who will not eat beans. But he knows that if he doesn't want to have the beans for dinner, he just sits it out. Okay, so we'll talk more about food next week, but you got to start that fairly early on and be willing to risk leaving a child hungry for a little while so that they can learn, oh my gosh, it would have been good if I had eaten that dinner. I would feel better right now. Okay, so the store. I used to get the question when I go to the grocery store with 4 children ages 4 and under, are they all yours? And I always wanted to say, who picks up extra toddlers when they're on their way to the grocery store? Nobody does that. Of course they're. Do you think if I had any other option than to be here with, you know, I don't even have room for groceries in the cart, for Pete's sake. So I know that of which I speak, okay? And so short-term approach to dealing with grocery shopping is, I know, I could leave them at home with someone, okay? So we have avoidance. That's our first technique. The second thing is, oh, I know, I can entertain them with something while they're in the store. So we hand them a screen to look at while they're there. Long-term, you want to raise a child who has self-control while shopping. No fits, no whining, no begging. So the earlier you start bringing that child to the store with you and engaging them in conversation while you're in the store, let them hold the things that are already in your cart. But if they're reaching that arm out, you know, that little barnacle arm trying to grab stuff, and you say, no touch, you know, and you train them, and they learn that we go through the store, and the store is not for grabbing, and if I ask for something, the answer is just no. The answer can be no there, okay? Because if they have to ask for it, it's not a treat. We'll talk about that more later. So resist the urge to make it easy on yourself initially, because it will be easier on you in the long run if your children know how to be content while they're on a shopping trip. And so just be careful that you are not parenting out of fear, that you are trying to avoid some negative response from the child, and that's why you're doing what you're doing. Parenting out of love is when you're cultivating self-control in the child. If your child throws a fit in the store, Are you ever in the store and you hear that kid howling and you're like, it is not my day to die. You know, it's someone else's kid just flipping out. What do? Take your child, take your cart over to the woman who's at the checkout lane and say, I need to leave this here for just a minute. Take the child into the bathroom or out to your car until the child has calmed down. And then say, if you're calm, we'll go back in the store. So the child knows you don't control me with your volume level. You don't control me. I'm still in charge, okay? It's not easy. Doesn't happen right the first time, but you got to fight for it. Very quickly, when you're in someone else's home, this is tough with a 9 to 24-month-old. Depends on how consistent you have been in your own home, how successful you'll be in keeping your child well-behaved at someone else's home. But you have to think long-term about self-control around the belongings of others. And this is why when you're at home, you have to go through the play of stop, look at mom, no touch, that whole thing, so that when you're at someone else's house and you say stop, your child stops, okay? Then very quickly, sleep time. You have to think about the long-term. You want a child who gets good rest at appropriate times. Isn't that what we all want? Because if your child gets that, so do you. So routine is going to be the key for success. Now, we know what happens with little children. They come out after you put them in. Once, as soon as they're able to wrangle their way out of the bed, they keep coming back out like little yo-yos. And so what can you do? Very calmly say, it's nighty-night time, and take them back to bed, okay? If they come back out again and again, if they don't want to give it up, and it's going to take a little while, okay? Most children have a lovey. Are you ready to hear my meanest thought ever? You take lovey and you say, go back to your bed. If you stay in bed, lovey will come back, okay? And so then if they stay in that bed for even 3 minutes, then you run back in there with lovey and go, good job, here's lovey, you know? And then they think, if I go out again, lovey is leaving me again, and I cannot face nighttime without lovey. It's really pretty effective. It may not work the first time. You have to want your own sleep so much that you will enforce their sleep, okay? So just consider using lovey for a little leverage.
Thank you for listening to audio from the Village Church, located in Texas. Feel free to make copies of this message to give to others, but please do not charge for those copies or alter the content in any way without permission. For more information about The Village Church, please visit us online at www.thevillagechurch.net.